From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a bill moving through Congress could let your employer demand you undergo genetic testing under the umbrella of employee wellness programs.
It sounds like it's being very supportive of employees, but I think a lot of it comes down to employer costs.
Pushing Michigan to the forefront of the mobility movement.
It's not a question of whether we need to do it. It's a question of us doing it and making it happen because our future depends on it.
Ford announces it's building a Lincoln SUV in China.
There aren't many places where you can have a big market where lots of new buyers are coming in, but that is the case with China.
Born a crack baby, today he mentors young people. There were bumps along that path. We'll hear his story. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How would you feel about your boss demanding that you undergo genetic testing and handing over those results to the boss? And if you refuse, you could wind up paying a penalty of up to 30% of the total cost of your health insurance. A bill that has just cleared a House committee last week would do exactly that. It's called the Preserving Employee Wellness Programs Act. It was approved by the House Committee on Education and the Workforce last Wednesday, and a vote that ran right along party lines with all 22 Republicans, including Michigan Representative Tim Walberg, supporting the measure, and all 17 Democrats opposing it. Elizabeth Barclay is a professor of management at Oakland University. She's been studying genetic testing and workplace discrimination for many years now. So glad to have you with us, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
What would this bill allow employers to do with the results of their employees' genetic testing results?
Well, it's a little unclear. It's possible that there could be additional costs for insurance. With a lot of the current wellness programs, they're tied to health insurance plans, and if you don't undergo cholesterol and blood pressure testing, then you pay a higher medical premium. So it's possible that if employees don't do this, they will be paying higher charges. And especially in employment at will state, employers can terminate you for any reason. A number of years ago up in Lansing, there were several employees who did not stop smoking, and they only smoked at home, and they were terminated by their boss because they didn't quit smoking. So it's possible that you could see terminations. You could possibly see employees not getting promoted into or responsible positions or not given access to training because of perceptions about their genetic background.
Doesn't this Preserving Employee Wellness Programs Act, doesn't it blow a big hole in the existing protection under the federal law known as GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act? That one blocks employers from insisting that we be genetically tested. And if it's part of a wellness program, it can be voluntary, right?
But if you're not voluntarily participating in the wellness program, then you're going to probably pay higher insurance premiums for your medical care. But one of the things that I think is interesting from what I've read so far is with a lot of these wellness programs, especially if they're tied into health care, this means that it's possible that the employee's spouse or partner would also be genetically tested or required to be tested. That person's not an employee. And then if I'm giving my genetic test to my employer, that also tells people about my children who aren't employees.
Why do employers want this, Elizabeth?
Well, I think that part of it seems to be driven by the idea of trying to reduce healthcare costs. So a lot of the wellness programs have their stated purpose of reducing healthcare costs and increases in insurance because people will be healthier. Some of the research seems to indicate that those programs don't have as much of an impact as employers had hoped, and rates are still going up. So I think that they're looking for different tools to try to reduce those costs. I'm not sure from looking at the bill that's proposed how it would empower or enable individuals to be healthier. What if you find out that you have a genetic disease that in 50 years might cause significant problems? Is that something that's relevant to your employer now? Does it really increase your healthcare costs now versus 50 years from now when you might already be retired?
These volunteer wellness programs, as you say, so much is centered around them and, you know, get healthy, you know, the yoga classes and the weight loss and quit smoking programs that are offered by the company. But the voluntary part doesn't seem so voluntary when you look closer. What is going on here? Because there certainly seems to be some legal maneuvering.
When we talk about this in our human resource management classes here, it sounds like it's being very supportive of employees, but I think a lot of it comes down to employer costs. There are people who go out and they try to be healthy regardless of one of these programs. If the only part of the program that you must adhere to is having some medical tests once a year, that doesn't necessarily encourage you to change your lifestyle or to eat healthier. In some ways, it also changes the relationship between you and your doctor, too, in terms of things that you might be able to do or be proactive to do.
Now, the ACA had already opened the door for employers to kind of get more directly involved in their employees' health. StatNews.com, which first reported on this pending bill, said the ACA allows employers to charge employees 30% and possibly 50% more for health insurance if they don't participate in the voluntary wellness programs. And the Obama administration ruled a workplace wellness program counts as voluntary, even if you have to pay thousands of dollars more in premiums and deductibles if you don't participate. What are your thoughts on what the ACA already allows, and how much of a change is this new proposal?
From reading the proposal, it looked like they were trying to clarify for employers what they could or couldn't do. But once again, when I'm looking at a lot of the wellness programs, while some employers might have gym memberships, I don't think they're requiring people to check in and show how often they go to the gym or they don't go to the gym. Here we have a wellness program, but the primary driver for lower health insurance is having your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and your weight checked once a year through the plan. And that's all that's submitted here for employees. So I think it just ties back into what people can be charged for their insurance over some lower rate.
You touched on a point that I wanted to get into a little more with you, that there seems to be some question about how effective these wellness programs are. And you stop and think it's an $8 billion industry, according to Stat News. What is your take? Are they effective, or what's the push, and why do companies like them if, as you say, costs are still going up?
It depends on the company. Like, I know that larger organizations like Microsoft really have a wide variety of things they do. So when you're hired at Microsoft, you have access to a gym that's conveniently located. You can also use wellness money to purchase a bicycle so you can bike to work, or you can buy exercise equipment and you have an account that you use that's not connected to your insurance. And so those kinds of incentives are particularly attractive to new employees and millennials. It really fits in with how they're viewing their lifestyle. Now, if you have a company that there's no conveniently located gym and your wellness program is that we're going to give you a pedometer and try to get everyone to walk 10,000 steps a day, but no one reports in, then you have a different impact.
So you can't paint them with the same brush.
Mm-hmm.
Who's lining up to oppose this new bill, the Preserving Employee Wellness Programs Act?
There's a large group that I just started reading about, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AARP, the March of Dimes, the National Women's Law Center, the House Democrats. Other medical and health advocacy groups are also lining up against this. And I think it has to do with who has access to this information. Now, it's interesting because we have laws protecting your health record. So, like, who gets these? Does it stay with the examining physician? If you're in an HMO and you have a primary care physician, have you been referred out to a genetic counselor to get these tests? Or are we all going to send our DNA into one of the, there's a number of places you can have your DNA done now. I mean, where's the store? Do we keep it in employee files? Who has access to it?
Yeah.
Who can interpret it? So if somebody's a carrier for a genetic condition, it's possible that means they're not going to get it. But is somebody going to interpret that as they have a disease?
Boy, there are so many questions. Now, unless I'm wrong, it appears that under this proposal, employers wouldn't be able to see the individual names connected to genetic testing information. Is that information correct?
I'm not sure about that. I do know that with health insurance vendors, when they have discussions with employers, the names are blocked out. But depending on the size of your company, you may know who the high user of insurance is just because everyone kind of knows what's going on. Like if somebody had used $100,000 of health insurance in a year because of some severe problem with them or a family member, you probably know who that is, even though it's redacted.
It doesn't take much to connect the dots, does it?
Mm-mm.
These wellness programs are so often run by contracted third parties. And as you talk about questions, it's certainly, here's another question, if they compile genetic testing information on Company A's employees, how restricted would they be from sharing that information either back to the company or outside marketers, for instance?
Yes, I think one of the news reports since this came out indicated that then employees may be targeted by through advertisements based on the results.
If this bill passes as written, Elizabeth, what options would people have if they don't want to hand over their genetic information to their employer?
I suppose that when one was looking for a job, one would want to find out whether this was part of the organization's strategy. On the other side, if it does pass, it does look like employers can charge a premium. I don't know whether employers would want to charge up to 30% more. I think that that could precipitate people searching for different jobs where this wouldn't be an issue.
That could be a really big kick in the wallet, couldn't it, when you're thinking about the annual cost?
And if you're looking at who might be against it, it might be people who are more educated about what happens with genetic tests and how they can be used. Maybe they would be more mobile about relocating to a different, less onerous environment.
What are you going to be watching for as this House Bill 1313 moves forward in the House?
I'd like to see what some of the discussion is. I read through the bill this week, and it doesn't look like everything is there. I don't see how this gets implemented or how it's going to affect employees beyond, you know, the news articles right now talking about the financial hit. But I really do think that there has to be more of a discussion of the ethics of this in terms of what are the implications. Because with a lot of our other legislation that tries to protect people, it's obvious gender, ethnicity, race, national origin, age, possibly physical disabilities. But this, when you're doing this genetic testing, it's not just that person. It's a whole network of people who aren't associated with that organization. It's your parents and your grandparents and your grandchildren. And that information would then be somewhere. And I just don't know how that's going to play out.
Elizabeth Barclay, professor of management at Oakland University. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We reached out to Representative Wahlberg's office to get the congressman's perspective on why he supports this bill. They did not respond to our request for an interview. Coming up in 10 minutes, a Detroit man's journey from teen drug dealer to successful businessman, writer, and mentor. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump wants U.S. carmakers to build those vehicles here in the U.S. U.S. carmakers want him to ease up on stiff emissions regulations. That's the framework for the president's visit with auto leaders today in Ypsilanti, coming right on the heels of Ford's announcement that its luxury Lincoln unit will start building an SUV in China. Theo Leggett is a global business reporter for the BBC, which is Stateside's partner, and with us now. Theo, I know that nobody builds cars in China without a Chinese partner. Who's Ford's partner in this venture?
It's a company called Changan, Cynthia. And as you say, yeah, any foreign company which wants to do business in a big way in China has to have a local partner. This is the one that Ford has chosen.
Is Ford building a new plant for this or using an existing one?
It's planning to build a new production line. And what's going on here is that there are very few markets in the world where car sales can be guaranteed to grow for a long period of time. If you look at the US market, companies sell a lot of cars, but it's mainly to people who've already got them. You know, you buy a car when your old one's worn out. There aren't many places where you can have a big market where lots of new buyers are coming in. But that is the case with China. People are getting richer. They want new cars. And there's a growing segment of the population who want upmarket luxury cars. And that's where Lincoln comes in. It's seen as an upmarket brand that's well established in the world.
And certainly it seems Chinese customers like Lincoln because sales jumped, what, like nearly 180% last year.
Yeah, this is something a lot of the automakers have been saying, that sales in China have been taking off. And in Lincoln's case, I think they sold 330,000 cars last year, which was nearly triple the previous year's figure. And this is because of the kind of car maker that Lincoln is seen as. Yes, in the United States, its reputation might have gone downhill in the past few years. They're seen as airport taxis to a certain extent. But in China, it's a long-established American mark, and that's what people want. In China, you get buyers who are backseat drivers. They're people who want a luxury car that somebody else drives, and they sit in the front looking grand. And that's the kind of market that Lincoln is able to tap into.
And we should recall that any cars imported into China are hit with a very steep tariff, aren't they?
They are, and that's one of the reasons why Ford wants to produce them locally. If you look at what's happening, at the moment Ford brings in Lincolns from the United States and it sells them. It's going to carry on doing that. But because the market in China is growing so quickly, it needs to be able to build them locally. Those cars will then also be able to avoid the import tariffs, and that's very, very important. But we should be very clear about what's going on here. Ford is not moving production from the United States to China. It's building cars in China for the local market.
That's right. We're not going to see those SUVs here in the US.
No, this is a car which we understand will be developed exclusively for the Chinese market. And that's because the Chinese market is, as I said, a bit different from some other markets. You know, if upmarket cars are sold in China, they're sold to the kind of person who sits in the back seat. Chinese buyers want particular things. I've discussed this with motor industry chief executives at the various car shows. And it is something they're all trying to do. Look at what the Chinese buyer wants and accommodate them. So it means building a different kind of product rather than simply importing what you'd sell in America.
It's left to be seen whether this move of Ford's will draw any fire from President Trump. We have seen that he's not afraid to unleash his Twitter on companies that he feels aren't putting America first.
No, absolutely. I mean, we saw that with Ford late last year, didn't we, where there was a lot of publicity over Ford deciding it wasn't going to move any Lincoln production to a plant in Mexico. And Donald Trump has made it very clear that he will not want to see any production moving out of the United States if it's for US consumption. I'm not convinced he would have the same issues with Ford building cars in China for the Chinese market, because ultimately that is something that doesn't cost American jobs and does get an American company higher revenues, so is ultimately of benefit to a US company. So I'm not convinced that this move will actually attract the ire of the White House, but you never know.
You don't. And of course, as we know, President Trump has been very forceful in accusing China of manipulating its exchange rate to get an unfair advantage in trade and to steal American jobs. And the BBC has learned there will be soon an interesting meeting at the president's Florida resort.
Yes, indeed. We understand that Xi Jinping is going to meet with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. We don't know when this is going to happen, but I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that meeting because, as you say, President Trump has made his views on China very clear. He sees the country as a currency manipulator, keeping its currency undervalued, that it overproduces products like steel and other things, dumps cheap exports onto US and other international markets, and gains unfair advantages. And the trade representative nominee, Robert Lighthizer, has taken up this belligerent tone. So, you know, it seems that Beijing is seen as one of the bad guys by the White House. And perhaps Beijing is getting a little bit worried about this because there is a lot of trade done between China and the United States, and they won't want to see a full-blown trade war out of this.
What's your best guess as to what President Xi's stance will be once he comes to Florida and sits down across a table from Donald Trump?
Well, I would imagine he'll remind President Trump that American companies do a lot of business in China, Ford among others, and that if there were to be a full-blown trade war, perhaps those companies could suffer. Now, China won't want to take action against American firms doing business in China because US companies, as we mentioned earlier, work in partnership with local businesses. In Ford's case, it's Changang. They benefit from the popularity of upmarket foreign brands, so it helps their sales, so they could lose out. But on the other hand, you do have companies where in the world, Europe, the rest of Asia, who might be willing to come in and take up the slack. So China will be reminding the United States that this is trade that works both ways, that American firms can benefit from a good trading relationship with China, and not to go too far on the rhetoric.
Theo Leggett, global business reporter with our partner, the BBC. Theo, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If anyone seemed destined for a life that would either end in a drug deal gone bad or in a prison, it would probably be Sean Blanchard. Everything in his early life pointed him down that path, beginning with the fact that Sean was a crack baby. He was born with crack cocaine in his system. Instead, Sean Blanchard is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he majored in math and economics. He attended Wayne State University's law school. He got a master's in secondary math education. He's now the CEO of Lion's Dream, and his memoir is titled, How About That for a Crack Baby? Keys to Mentorship and Success. Sean, so good to have you with us on Stateside.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little about what life was like as you grew up on Detroit's West Side.
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting because, you know, you grow up and all you know is what you know. And so we all have good examples or bad examples, and hopefully you may not know what to do, but you know exactly what not to do. So growing up, I was given to my grandparents, and so there was a male and a female in the household. They weren't the college type, worked in plants. And
we should say you were given to your grandparents because your parents just weren't,
right,
weren't able to do the job?
Well, you know what? So what happened was, so I was born with drugs in my system. Mm-hmm. And my mom, she's a professional shoplifter. And she didn't necessarily know what to do with kids. Her mother was raising the kids that she already had. And it was a matter of I was just a bit too much. Mm-hmm. And so my father, he was just kind of... Maybe a rolling stone, I should say.
Got it.
And he had his own family that he was cultivating at the time. So I was given to my grandparents. I mean, thank God for grandparents. Mm-hmm. You know, you grow up and I had cousins that were more like my brothers and sisters, although I have 7 brothers and 5 sisters. Unfortunately, 3 of my brothers now are deceased and 3 of them have served time in prison. And one of them is actually serving a life sentence and has 11 children, which is very interesting.
It sure is. So the deck was stacked against you.
The deck was stacked up. Mm-hmm. The deck was definitely stacked up. So even, you know, I had some brothers that would sell drugs and they've been killed in drug transactions. And, you know, it's a matter of these are the people that you look up to. And, I mean, by the time I was 11 years old, I was cutting crack and on shoplifting excursions all across the country with my mother. And I felt the need to make sure that I can make ends meet and make money from doing illegal means and didn't see it as something that was bad. I can recall times, even in my book, where shoplifting just wasn't my thing. And, you know, this one time my mom, she bust my lip wide open because I didn't do the wrong thing right. Mm. And it was at that point that I just understood that I had to really begin to make my own rules in life because I didn't necessarily agree with the rules that everyone else had around me.
And you were seeing where it was leading them. And am I correct that your grandmother died when you were pretty young?
Yeah. See, mm-hmm. My grandmother died when I was 12 years old. And when she died, I had no more rules any longer. So at that point, I had a roof over my head to stay with my grandfather, but he was like a roommate.
There was nobody pushing you to do well in school or follow rules.
How
does a kid from that kind of background, like I said, it certainly looked like a path to follow the way your brothers did. How did you wind up graduating from the University of Michigan?
Yeah, and so that's what's so interesting. My grandmother always told me I was smart, and so I believed it. And so by the time she left, being smart and doing good in school was something that Sean just did. Mm-hmm. And so it just so happens that, you know, I go to high school. I have a brother that gets shot. My father passes away. This is 9th grade. My other brother gets shot about 9 times and then goes to federal prison for about 4 years. And so I'm sitting there and I'm like, wow, grandma's gone. My brother's gone. My brother, who's a twin, is gone and his twin is gone. My mom is shoplifting somewhere. I guess I got to do what I got to do. So I began to raise my younger brother, who's 5 years younger than me. And I had to make the rules for him and I abided by my rules. And school was one of them. And so I didn't even have a destination, right? I just knew go to school. All the people I knew ended up in a plant somewhere.
Right. So where that was going to lead you, you didn't see that.
Who knows, yeah. Right?
What was the difference? Who made the difference?
I had this woman. Her name was Miss Champion. Absolutely beautiful. One of the most beautiful women I've ever met in my life at that point. And she was a graduate of the University of Michigan.
And she was your high school counselor.
That's right. Yeah. She was my high school counselor. and she had just graduated, and I would listen to whatever she told me to do. It was interesting because she, you know, she didn't know the depths of what I was going through, but she knew some things were a bit off. And so I had someone once again now to show my report card because no one else was paying attention. And because of her, she's like, you know what? You're going to take the ACT. You're going to do this. You're going to be my Michigan man. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. I'm like, yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Whatever that means, I'm in.
Sure.
Yes.
Good. That's cool. And I had no clue what Michigan was. I didn't know this was some premier school. I didn't know what that was. I just knew the Fab Five was cool. Mm-hmm. Like the big basketball shorts. Chris Webber's from Detroit. That's all I know.
You're a kid. What do you know?
What do I know? But she actually set it up. So I followed the rules. I got on the debate team like she told me. I was in compact like she told me. You know, I did some extracurricular activities outside of my extracurricular activities, mm-hmm. which were selling drugs and doing all types of different scams. I would make sure I did what she said as well. And doing that, she had on-site admissions. The University of Michigan came to the school. And while everyone else was there with their parents and some type of guardian or someone else, I was there with Ms. Champion.
And you got accepted on the spot.
On the spot.
What, looking back, does it strike you what an amazing long shot that was? Like the stars really aligned
right.
for Sean
yeah.
Blanchard on that day, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, absolutely, because I didn't even write down a personal statement. I came in there. She told me the day of. She went and got my information. I had my transcripts, mm-hmm. and they waited until I was last. Everyone else go ahead. Everybody get out of here. Mm-hmm. And Sean, they said, where's your personal statement? Let's have it.
Yeah.
And she said, you know what, Sean, just tell them your story. I told them where I was from, my makeup. I had a job at Red Lobster. I was raising my younger brother. I had about a 3.5. I was involved in school, doing this and doing that. And I know that if I had a shot at some school where I could be upwardly mobile and exposed to more than my immediate environment, then I would be able to make the world a better place beyond just my own life.
And so you came to U of M, math major.
That's right.
Economics.
Mathematics and economics.
How was the transition for you, Sean?
You know what? It was interesting because I came into the Bridge program. Mm-hmm. I got all A's. And
we should tell everybody the Bridge program is.
That's right. The Summer Bridge program mm-hmm. is a transition program from high school to college here at mm-hmm. Michigan. And so I did very well there. And when I started in the fall, I just continued to do well. I mean, I was running laps around the grades, A's, B's. You know, I didn't really think it wasn't difficult. It was just new.
Yeah.
So it was just the fact that, oh, no one else has ever challenged me like this before, but no problem.
You rose to that. Mm-hmm. But some of the old habits died a little hard, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, that's right. So coming here, I actually, you know, they took the boy out of the hood, but they didn't take the hood out of the boy. So I came here and I was still selling weed. I was still doing scams. Mm-hmm. And I messed around my sophomore year. Despite having about a 3.5 GPA here, I found myself in the county jail.
Mm.
And from there, I found myself on probation for the rest of my years here at the University of Michigan.
You had to have had a moment where you thought, oh, my gosh, I've blown it.
Oh, my gosh. Listen, when I went into the jail, I remember being in a holding cell. And while I was there, there was a guy who came in grunting. And he began to urinate. Mm-hmm. And it's an open field. You can just see somebody urinating, like, next to you. And so he's urinating in the toilet, and he begins to put his hands in it and swish it around in the piss. Mm-hmm. And begins to pat his head, and there's piss splashing. And so we're like, oh, my God, watch the piss. This is mm-hmm. crazy. Mm-hmm. And then another guy looks at me and says, ha-ha, first time, huh?
He could see that look in your eye.
And I said, ha ha, last time. But I remember I looked up and I saw my face on a television screen. And it was at that moment that it was just shattered, you know. And I figured that I would get kicked out of Michigan. I saw my life flash before my eyes. And I figured that, you know, how could I go back to this prestigious university when they finally found me out?
But they let you back on probation.
You know what? The school never said anything. Which is interesting. Actually, my professors were calling to bail me out. And so, you know, I prayed and said the realest prayer I ever said to date at that point. And I vowed my life to make sure that young people would never be placed in that position that I was in ever again.
And I know from your book, How About That for Crack Baby, you have taken the mentoring that was given to you by Tanya Champion, your high school counselor, and you have mentored others. So you've been paying it forward.
Absolutely. I mean, adopting youth, bringing a lot of people, taking care of a lot of people, making sure that I could even take it a step further beyond the sheer motivation and conversation, but coming to my home, this is what you need, this is the path, and doing what she did by making sure that she can open the doors and pathways, introduce me to people to shake hands with that can be sponsors for me. That's what I do for people now, and that's something that I live for.
Sean Blanchard, the memoir, How About That for a Crack Baby. Great talking with you, and congratulations on the book, and I know there's a lot of success ahead for you and a lot of lives to change.
Thank you.
Up next, how the Motor City is working to become the mobility city.
The critical mass of capability is anchored here in Southeast Michigan.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The push is on to get Detroit and Southeast Michigan right there to the forefront of the mobility movement, to reshape the Motor City into the Mobility City, a center for innovation in 21st century transportation and mobility. And that push is even getting the attention of our president, who is visiting Ypsilanti today. Here with us is Gene Redfield, the president and CEO of Next Energy, and Glenn Stevens. He's the executive director of Mich Auto and the vice president of Automotive and Mobility Initiatives. I want to start by getting a sense of what does that term mobility city, when I say that term, what does it mean to you, Gene?
For me, mobility city is the city of the future where the mobility needs, how do I get from point A to point B, are met for everybody. With the timeliness, the convenience, the consumer experience, and the cost that the user expects.
And your take, Glenn?
Well, mobility city to me means it's not just how cars move or how people move. It's how goods and services and data flows freely and efficiently. And that's really what mobility encompasses.
And that's something that we want to see in Detroit, we want to see in Michigan, and be a national leader?
We do, because there's a tremendous economic impact from it, but really there's primarily a safety reason for it. And as we connect things and the world becomes more connected, there's an opportunity to make the world safer. 1 million people lost their lives on global world roads last year, 960-some on Michigan roads last year, and we're up 40% this year. So using technology to make things safer and moving data, goods, and services more safe is important. But that economic impact to be part of this IoT auto-connected world is really, really a significant opportunity for us.
Gene, we know there are a lot of cities that are really in the hunt to become the leader in autonomous vehicles, the leader in transportation innovation. We've seen Pittsburgh's teamed up with Uber and has driverless cars on their streets as we speak. Silicon Valley's got a lot of the technology, talent, and the culture. Where is Detroit fitting into this race, do you think?
Well, I think Detroit has some things really going for it. First of all, as Glenn mentioned, the critical mass of capability is anchored here in Southeast Michigan. What we know about cars, what we know about connected technologies, and what we know about safety positions us uniquely compared to places like Pittsburgh and Silicon Valley. Where we're a little bit of a Johnny-come-lately, but making great strides in a short amount of time, is really getting together as a region around transportation and mobility issues so we can actually get deployments, not just development, going on here. And I think you'll be hearing some things over the next weeks and months about how those things are starting to take off in the city of Detroit and in the region as a whole.
Yeah, I would echo. Gene and I and our organizations work very closely together with other partners around the state. We formed the Michigan Mobility Initiative almost 2 years ago, and we have been actively working to position the state, promote the state as a center for that, but also make sure we have policy and talent for the industry as we move forward. So we do have the greatest automotive cluster, and there's more automotive and connected vehicle research being done here anywhere in the world. But we have to leverage all that for our future and build that.
And I think it's important to note that it's not just research. There are real-world things going on where things are taking the street. The two cohorts of Techstars mobility companies and what they're doing around mobility as a service initiatives, as well as other mobility businesses and how they're anchored and growing in Michigan is one sort of proof point. The other thing, we've got a couple things going on at Next Energy that are mobility as a service type pilots. We have one where it's electric vehicles and college students working car share issues and really trying to understand what's the consumer experience and what are the implications for how the car is designed. And then we have one around e-scooters, electrified scooters, 30-mile range, 30 miles an hour, car share or vehicle share type model. Who cares? How does that work in a city like Detroit? How do people expect to use them? What are the implications then for both the consumer interface and also the vehicle itself in terms of how battery life and some of the other design issues associated with e-scooters. So we do have mobility pilots active in the city.
Absolutely.
They're a little below the radar compared to the big splashy Uber announcements in places like Pittsburgh.
But it's bubbling away.
Yeah, and one of the things we suffer from a little bit in the Midwest is we are an engineering culture where we design it, we build it, we make sure it works before we pick our head up and say anything. And we're competing with a California dreaming culture where they just put out a bold vision and talk about it as if it's real already. And at some point,
Midwestern modesty.
Midwestern modesty, stick to our knitting and get the real work done around manufacturing, around safety, around trials, and then talk about what's possible and how we're ready to move.
Glenn, what do we need in infrastructure investment, especially in the Detroit area in Southeast Michigan?
Well, and it's an interesting time because of the election and the conversation that's happening about potential commitment, significant commitment to infrastructure, and our nation needs that. We're woefully inadequate. And as we invest in infrastructure, there's an opportunity to make it connected infrastructure. And that's what we need to do. So I give Kirk Steitel and the Michigan Department of Transportation an incredible amount of credit for being visionary in that. But we need the research projects. So we need to put the infrastructure projects in place like the American Center for Mobility, like M-City, like Kettering University's General Motors Research Center. But as we expand and as we redo and repave and put new roads and systems in, we have to make sure that it's communicating with the transportation and the goods and the services that are free flowing, like I talked about with mobility.
And I think there's one more thing to think about with infrastructure. And I think we're starting to get the policy leaders and the industry partners thinking that way, which is the idea of there's a future of infrastructure that's not each of the silos where roads are transportation infrastructure and the grid is the energy infrastructure and the telecoms is the data infrastructure. The reality is all three of those major infrastructure elements are starting to converge. Our energy networks, our data networks, and our physical land use networks around parking and transit and roads are converging. How do we think about that? How do we invest in that? And how do we make sure that those infrastructure elements get built so we can support these mobility solutions going forward and the new building energy management and energy efficiency solutions going forward and the distributed renewables and clean energy options going forward? We're building our 21st century cities, and we need to be using 21st century technologies to do so.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the push to make Michigan and Southeast Michigan in particular right up front in the race to become the leading mobility city in the nation. Talking with Gene Redfield, who's president and CEO of Next Energy, and Glenn Stevens, who's executive director of Mich Auto and the VP of Automotive and Mobility Initiatives. Glenn, have you seen any early returns on your efforts to attract talent to the Detroit area?
We have. And because we've been working in a very concerted effort and in a collaborative, that's the neat thing that we've seen over the last few years, driven by leadership in the state with the governor, the mayor, other executive leaders, you know, really people coming together to get on the same page as opposed to operating in silos or in conflict. So we're starting to see dividends with companies say, you know, It's not just automotive that's happening in Michigan, but these next generation mobility solutions are being driven and led here. And we're starting to see companies like Uber, like Google with their FCA arrangement. I was at Harman Automotive the other day, 1,000 engineers in a building in Farmington Hills in their new tech center. Incredible. And obviously Samsung has just made an acquisition move towards them. So this automotive tech convergence is happening. And now what we're seeing is not only do we design and build and integrate vehicles of today, but there's a recognition that we have the technology to do it for the connected vehicle and build the connected vehicle here too. So the focus is shifting here pretty dramatically. And I think that's a result of the work that we're collectively doing.
And is the talent coming?
So the talent is really multifaceted. We don't look at talent one-dimensionally. We have to look at how do we convince and how do we attract our youth to get more interested in the STEM focus or STEAM focus, and how do we grow our talent? Because we really have to grow it. That's the best pipeline we can do. So there's a steady stream and need for mechanical and electrical engineers, but above and beyond that now is this incredible thirst for software and systems and control engineers. So we have to do that. We have to attract people to come here. We have to utilize new Americans. So immigration issues and immigration reform are key. Veterans, my understanding is there are upwards of 300,000 veterans that come back into the workforce every year in this country. So we as a state, and we are doing this, have to look at holistically about how we attract and develop talent for today's industry and tomorrow's industry.
Let's look at putting the pieces together. And you mentioned University of Michigan has its M-City test site up and running, and we've been following the development of the American Center for Mobility, the $80 million driverless car test site that's being built at Willow Run. Flint, we've got Kettering University and GM building their mobility research center. Are these all complementing each other, or are we seeing any duplication of efforts in these?
Oh, I think the biggest thing that the region's got going on is the fact that we have the complementarity, that we have the capability to research, design, test, and deploy all in the same region. I mean, I would put even Next Energy Center into that mix. The work that we do around connected technologies with our DSRC testbed, USDOT certified testbed for connected vehicles, as well as electrification of vehicles, is definitely on the forefront of what's done all around the world. And so, you know, between the university research and talent, the early test tracks and development centers, and then cooperation for deployments around the region, I think Southeast Michigan is really poised to be that mobility capital.
And I definitely would say we're complementing because we're communicating. We use the Michigan Mobility Initiative, and we meet regularly, and we talk and communicate that way. But, you know, around the state, I was in Grand Rapids last week talking to them about Planet M and what we're doing with mobility solutions for Michigan. I was in Michigan Tech a couple months ago because they're doing incredible research up there because they have the snow facility to do connected vehicle. And as they put it up there, and I'm from the UP for Marquette, they put it up there, our weather is reliably crappy. And it's true because that when the snow sets in. But to be able to do vehicle testing in that environment is extremely important.
Looking at the whole state, a hit and a miss, I think, in a sense. We saw the legislature move very quickly with a lot of bipartisan harmony to pass those bills allowing driverless vehicles on Michigan roads. Governor Snyder signed them into law. Senator Ken Horn of Franklin quoted as saying, this is the equivalent of the race to space.
Mm-hmm.
You're agreeing?
Absolutely. I think the idea of connected technologies and how they change our world is the space race of the 21st century. The challenge is it's not a single-minded focus. You know, the space race was land on the moon. The connected technologies future is a whole ecosystem of new technologies, new business models, and new players coming in and working with established players in new and different ways. So it's as aggressive as the space race and even harder to go after because it's not the single-minded focus but a whole ecosystem of capabilities and capacity that has to come together. And I think Michigan's getting its act together on that idea of the ecosystem and the collaboration and cooperation that requires.
And getting those public acts was a big important piece.
Incredible amount of bipartisan coalition that came together. I give Senator Cole a tremendous amount of credit because he's been a leader out on the front of this, and obviously Senator Horn, the governor. But we got it to where it needed to be to make sure that we stay in a place where effective, safe, controlled, And aggressive and progressive testing and research is enabled here in Michigan for companies to be here to do it. The companies that are here or the companies that want to come here to be part of this cluster of innovation.
Let's talk about a couple that things that look like setbacks. First of all, Detroit losing out on a number of competitive grants to improve transportation in the region. How bad a hit is that? And what do you see as how big an obstacle is that for our region, Gene?
I think it was definitely a disappointment because having those federal funds as seed for additional private leverage is always helpful. It's a reason for folks to come together and put their money where their mouth is to get things moving further faster. But I think Detroit is well positioned. I think we've had a pretty aggressive leadership acting in a very forward-leaning manner to get noticed by the USDOT and other federal agencies, and to actually put forward really compelling and aggressive plans that Detroit is probably best positioned to run with.
Well, it's a setback, but we also have to be realistic about where we just came from, and that's a city that was in bankruptcy and turmoil. So when the mayor took office, and he's put an incredible team in place, they have been focused on basic city services and getting those established in place, the lights back on, ambulances showing up on time. I mean, that's first. So now we're at a point where he's starting to, you know, talk about his vision for what Detroit looks like into the future, and things are happening in that space. So really, you know, always with a setback, you have to look at what's the opportunity for movement forward. And we see a lot of coalition work being done for us to collectively say, hey, I'm working in this space and you're working in this space. Why don't we work on these mobility solutions together? So we see it as opportunity. And the DOT and the White House Task Force has been extremely helpful to the city in helping us move forward.
What is the failure of the Regional Transit Authority millage proposal? What does that mean for Detroit's efforts or Southeast Michigan's efforts to become a mobility leader?
Well, that was a disappointment. We collectively put a lot of effort into that, and really to have that capability as the backbone for mobility is really something we desperately needed, and we still need. So we're going to reset and move forward and, again, you know, learn from what we learned and take it not as a setback, but how do we do this better for the future? How do we communicate it regionally? And so it was a setback at the time, but having that backbone of regional transit to be able to add on or bolt on or integrate with mobility as a service is absolutely essential for mothers to be able to get to the hospital for health care, for students to be able to get to school, and for people to be able to get to work.
In other words, voters, we're going to see you in 2 years and try again.
We have to try again. We've got to put these solutions in place.
Why should we be optimistic about mobility in Detroit, in Southeast Michigan, and really for the state of Michigan, Gene?
Well, I think the main reason for optimism about mobility in Detroit and Southeast Michigan is because of the capacity we have here, the talent, the assets, the companies that are already here, and the vision that the public and private sector leaders have put out in front for ourselves, for our region, but also as suppliers of mobility solutions for the planet. I mean, we have some of the largest OEMs on the planet shifting from automotive to mobility. And what that means for them in terms of business model, in terms of product design, in terms of new product service offerings, not just in Detroit, but in London, in Mumbai, in Shanghai. They get that, and they're moving aggressively forward with that. And I think that partnership of those global solutions anchored in Southeast Michigan is really compelling.
Glenn Stevens, you get the last word.
Well, I think we should be optimistic because of our DNA and our culture and our history. I mean, we put the world on wheels. So why not put the world into an autonomous vehicle and develop it, research it here, design and engineer it and build it here? And I think that's what we're going to do. We've got great blueprints in place. Business leaders from Michigan had the foresight to put Global Center for Mobility in their turnaround plan. The governor's leading. We've got private companies doing this. And I think we've got the coalitions and the people that want to work together to build this future for us. And again, it's important because technology can help save lives and because the economic impact of what this can mean for our state. It's not a question of whether we need to do it. It's a question of us doing it and making it happen because our future depends on it.
Glenn Stevens is the executive director of Mich Auto and vice president, automotive and mobility initiatives, and Gene Redfield, president and CEO, Next Energy. Pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth.
Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lee Smesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.